Welcome to the final show of Talking Peace, Insights on Peace and Justice with the Western New York Peace Center. The Western New York Peace Center is in its 48th year. I'm your host, Charlie Bowman. I was never suicidal before I came here, but being locked in a cell 23 or 24 hours a day is worse than death. It feels like hell. All I think about are different ways I could commit suicide. I tell mental health, but they don't help. I've tried to kill myself in many ways. I hung myself, and they cut me down. I have cut my wrists and with a pen and with glass. I have drunk Nair and swallowed pills, all because I cannot take it here. Close quote. Those are the words of an anonymous prisoner after 1.5 years in solitary confinement at Rikers Island Prison. My guests today are Sam, Rosalie, Chuck Culhane, Steve Hart, and Jane Mack. Sam and Chuck Culhane will tell about their experiences as prisoners in solitary confinement in New York State prisons. Rosalie will tell the story about her son in solitary, now out of solitary, but still imprisoned in New York State. Steve Hart and Jane Mack lead the Western New York chapter of the Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement and are experts in solitary confinement issues and are working to pass the HALT bill, which will limit solitary confinement in New York State. So we'll discuss that bill. But before we do that, the title of today's show is The Torture of Solitary Confinement. My guests today are Sam, Rosalie, Chuck Culhane, Steve Hart, and Jane Mack. Sam and Chuck Culhane will tell about their experiences as prisoners in solitary confinement in New York State prisons. Rosalie will tell the story about her son in solitary, now out of solitary, but still imprisoned in New York State. And Steve Hart and Jane Mack are all experts on confinement issues and are working to pass the HALT bill, the Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Isolated Confinement, which will limit solitary confinement in New York State. This bill, if passed, will correct many of the wrongs of solitary confinement here. And today's show is entitled The Torture of Solitary Confinement. So, Steve, I want to start with you. Welcome to the show. And can you tell us what is solitary confinement?
Well, I think that you're going to hear the best definition of it, in a way, by the experience of people who've actually been in it. But it passes under many different names. Sometimes it's called SHU, segregation, the box, Bing. And basically it means that people are kept in extreme isolation, where they are separated from the general population, are not part of any of the programming structures that exist in prisons, see practically nobody. They typically get meals through slots in their cells, don't go out of their cells except for 1 hour a day, maybe if they're lucky, for recreation, and therefore are almost completely cut off from normal human interaction and contact.
Jane, can you expound on what Steve just said? Could you add some comment on that? So. Nope, I didn't hear. Is there a microphone on?
Sounded like nope.
Okay, all right. The lights are left on for 24/7, and the cell is 6 feet by 10, something like that. We have pregnant women in solitary. We have elderly. We have children. New York State has roughly 5,000 people in solitary at this hour.
Hey, Charlie, I just want to give the phone number out here. 878-5104 will get you on to the discussion.
Right.
Area code 716-878-5104. Go ahead, Charlie.
Yeah, thank you, Jack. Okay. It's almost like a wartime imprisonment and we've had some experiences with that, which we'll mention later. But today we have two people that experienced solitary confinement. We have Chuck Culhane. And Chuck, can you tell us about your experiences in solitary and perhaps, if you will, why you were placed in solitary, or maybe you, if you don't want to go that route, that's fine. But
I was in prison from 1966 until 1992. And during the period of 1971 to 1973, almost 3 years, I was under sentence of death in New York. That was solitary, you know. They took the worst rules from the segregation unit and the worst rules from the old death house in Sing Sing, and they just created a terrible situation for people, deprived of almost everything. So everything that we eventually got over the three-year period, we kind of fought for. We did hunger strikes and physical confrontations and things. nothing came easy. But I tell you, back then, then after the death penalty was abolished in 72, we went to general population. We had sentences of 25, after the third trial, sentences of 25 years to life. And it was very rare when people were sent to the box. I mean, it was a rarity. You had to hit a guard or stab somebody, you know. It was very hardly used at all.
So outdated use of outdated toothpaste would not result in solitary confinement. Is that safe to say back then? Or
no.
As Chelsea Manning now is fighting that issue to keep away from solitary.
Yeah, so ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. It is. While you're on death row, you were on solitary, and then when you came off, you were back in the general population.
Yeah,
and then you were released from prison at some point.
1992.
I
would mention though that that there was phenomenal growth, negative and. Since in the 70s up through the 90s, quadrupled the population from, say, 300,000 to 2.3 million today. Along with that increase came harsher policies. I mean, if you're controlling 300,000 people across the nation, when you're controlling 2.3 million, It's another story,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
And so they created a lot of mechanisms to keep the control very much, keeping people in control. An example, in New York, they would normally send people back when. They would normally send people only for a serious thing. now, what they did, say, a decade ago, a decade and a half, they created all these little S units next to prisons, next to maximum or medium security prisons, and they're like locked down 24/7, you know, I forget the number of them, but there was probably at least 1,000 new punishment cells created. Yeah, and once the concrete goes in, it's not, you know, they're not going to turn around for years and years. What brought the solitary confinement pretty much onto the front burner was, of course, Michelle Alexander's great book, The New Jim Crow.
Right. Everybody in the world should read that.
Yeah. And great. She connects all the dots, and people interested in criminal justice should definitely read that. What was my train of thought there?
So the solitary issue arose with the drug laws. The drug laws.
Yeah, that was the vehicle to get the people into prison.
Yeah.
But the thing of solitary, I mean, there's like 80,000 people nationwide in solitary confinement.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge number. It's a small city.
Yeah.
And that happened through the drug laws was the vehicle for expanding the whole system.
Yeah.
What did happen was, hunger strikes broke out in California, particularly. I hear the phone ringing.
Charlie, you got to take the cell phone off there.
Oh, okay.
Someone's trying to call you. Call 878-5104. We'll put you right on.
Yeah, okay. So, Chuck, Anyway, so we New York State has about 5,000 people in solitary now.
I believe that's the number.
Every year, New York State releases 2,000 people directly from solitary into the general population. Mm-hmm. Now, here we have an individual who has, lost their ability or to communicate with other people on a normal mm-hmm. basis. And we're releasing them. I mean, many people recover that ability. You have wonderfully recovered that ability. Mm. And most people do, but some people cannot do that. I mean, they have, almost permanently damaged psyche over that. And those people need help. And obviously they don't have the resources to pay for, psychological help. So, I mean, this is, this is one of the wrongs that the HALT bill will correct, and the issue of the drug laws is this terrible drug issue, these draconian drug laws that we have in New York State should be stopped or eliminated. I want to get to Sam, and Sam is a experienced solitary. In the Clinton or the in one of the prisons upstate New York, and Sam, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, Sam, you are now successful. You have a successful new business somewhere in Buffalo,
yes.
And Sam is not your real name, but can you tell us, about your experiences in solitary confinement? Perhaps if you could tell us why you were sent there, maybe not, I don't know.
My experience come from 2012, incarcerated 2012, was sent to federal facility in upstate New York, Raybrook. And I was sent to solitary confinement because I had an incident with a CO. And the CO felt that I was getting out of my bounds with speaking to him, And it was an issue where he was saying something to me when his co-officers was there. I was responding as an inmate, properly.
Yeah.
And he felt that I was being a little too aggressive in my speech and not so submissive. So they concocted a situation because these COs are a community. They work together, they live together, they go out together,
mm-hmm.
And they concocted a situation where I went to work, come back, my things were confiscated, and they come to me, put me in handcuffs, and took me to the SHU.
Yeah.
I get to the SHU, they write up a ticket, and the ticket wasn't given to me. The ticket's supposed to be given to you within 7 days. They didn't get a ticket until like a week later.
Oh.
And this is like, for me to defend myself and to get my boundaries going right. I need to get everything properly, but it really don't care. And it's really a thing where to incarcerate the incarcerated and to sometimes a scare tactic, but sometimes to suppress you.
Now, did you go before a judge before you went into solitary? Did you have representation?
And
did you have a lawyer to help you fight the charges that you were,
No, they say when you get an handbook, when you go to any facility, any state or federal facility, you get a handbook. An handbook explains to you such disciplinary conditions and ways to handle the disciplinary. You can grievance any situation or any ticket that's brought your way. You can grievance that, but 9 times out of 10, the officer, the lieutenant who's the grievance officer, they bypass that, because once again, they look out for their own and they are community. So if I was to say, yo, where's my ticket? I didn't receive my ticket. Where's my ticket? I need to see my ticket to know what I'm being charged with. They would say, well, it's coming, we have to do this. And this person's not here at the time and this person's not there at the time. So yeah, they will spin you in such a way that, you have no choice because you already in the SHU.
Yeah.
So what can you do?
So how long did you spend in the SHU?
Actually, I was supposed to send up to 6 months, but mine was 4 months.
Okay. And can you describe a typical day in the SHU?
Well, you wake up in the morning for breakfast, but me, I would get up and do exercise. I would do me some exercise, cardiovascular exercise to, you know, keep my body, you know, in motion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we would eat a breakfast. Then I would take my books and read my books. And my books would actually get me through the day, you know, to keep my mind stimulated,
yeah,
to keep, you know, myself going. The typical guy, they will go to sleep and, you know, just try to sleep through the day. They will, you are given a shower every 2 days in this, okay, particular facility. Every 2 days you get a shower.
Mm-hmm.
And you will go outside. It depends on if the CO wanted to take you out.
Okay.
So every day wasn't exactly a 23 to, you know, 1 hour, you know, lockdown.
Yeah.
You're out for hours. Some days you're locked up for all day.
Yeah. Yeah. You were originally done for 8 months, and what, and you
did six
for
four,
so was it good behavior that they let you release you, or did you have help, or?
No, they needed room.
Oh.
They needed room. It, okay, it was a busy practice. They needed room. I said, so this guy been long enough, you know,
yeah,
he's not,
yeah,
so bad,
okay,
you know. Maybe,
yeah,
we could say good behavior, you know,
yeah,
this guy's not so bad, you know,
yeah,
he's...
I think Buffalo can tell this guy is not so bad, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, so, Buffalo gave me opportunity, so yeah,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But
so,
yes, it wasn't a thing of, we can't say exactly good behavior, because it was guys in there, there was situations more smaller than mine, you know.
Uh-huh.
Some guys, they needed to get away from persecution, certain situations inside the facility.
Yeah.
And they use it almost like... a protective custody, and they use it sometime, you know, to punish.
Yeah.
But to me, it's the conditions they send you through, the conditions and how you're treated and the food and the, you know, okay, the human to dehumanize you.
Yeah, I think our producer is telling we have to take a break.
No, I got a question.
Oh, okay.
I got a question. The question, okay, is, all right, say you have the option of death or lifelong solitary confinement. Which is worse, in your opinion? And I'll ask Chuck the same question.
Death or lifetime, yeah, solitary confinement? Well, we as humans are, we are social beings. You know, we're not like tigers. Tigers are more solitary. We are social beings, so we're meant to be social. Well, sometime in solitary confinement, you're not always, you know, by yourself. You know, these are some rooms or cells have two people in them. But it could be somewhere, someone from another country. In a federal facility, it may be someone from Colombia, or someone from Russia, you know, or someone from Burma. It can be someone from anywhere, you know. They put you with these people, and there is no communication. So they put you in a person that don't speak English, you know. But you are more social, but it's their dehumanization. We all know life is better than death, you know. But there is a mental and a spiritual death that we talk about with solitary confinement.
Yeah, go ahead, Chuck. You want to answer the question, and then I have a question.
Yeah, briefly. My fear was not the death penalty so much, because after studying it, I saw that it's applied with discrimination against blacks and Latinos, especially in New York. And I had a hung jury the first trial, so there's reasonable doubt in the case. So the death penalty never scared me. What did scare me was that I may have to do 10, 20, or more years, including life. I mean, that was a real fear, and it turned out to be one that I realized. I did 26 years before I was released on that case.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, I mean, for me, it was I would have preferred death to a life of solitary, but it turned out that you know, life prevailed.
Yeah,
thankfully.
Yeah. Do we go to break now, or do we have a few seconds? So, I think.
Well, we could go to just a quick early break,
and then we got to get to Rosalie here.
Yeah,
if we come back from the break. We'll ask Rosalie to tell a story about her son, who's still in prison, but did spend significant time in solitary confinement in New York State prison.
So the number to reach us here is 878-5104, and we'll be back with Talking Peace.
You said 5104.
5104. I'm sorry, 878-5104. I've only been here 30 years.
Right.
You think I know better?
You just gave out your parents.
No.
Welcome to Talking Peace. This is Talking Peace, Insights on Peace and Justice with the Western New York Peace Center. I'm your host, Charlie Bowman. And today's show is about solitary confinement, and we're talking about the torture of solitary confinement. And we should mention the longest person in the United States serving in solitary confinement is Albert Woodfox in Louisiana. And he's been in there for 42 years now. And a federal judge said he should be released from solitary and from prison, but Louisiana is fighting that tooth and nail. We want to get to Rosalie. Rosalie has a son in prison. And Rosalie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. And could you tell us the story of your son, without mentioning names, and what was it like for him, and also you? What was it like for you to have your son in solitary confinement?
Well, it was heartbreaking for me. They leave the lights on 24 hours, so I mess with his sleep pattern. And then they videotape you 24 hours to watch you for you don't commit suicide, but there's still people committing suicide, so how are they really watching them?
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't know if we have statistics on the number of people committing suicide in solitary confinement. Maybe Steve can weigh in on that later. I mean, when, how long was your son in solitary?
He was in solitary confinement for 8 months. And then when they put him back in population, it was hard to adjust because it was loud and everything. It was real noisy. He wasn't used to being in population.
Yeah. And was he able to read books, or was he able to?
Oh, yeah. He read books and everything. And when you're in a solitary confinement, you can only call once every 2 weeks.
Okay.
And when we would go see him, we would be see him behind the glass and have to talk to him on the phone.
Yeah. So you couldn't touch him. You couldn't hold his hand.
No.
You couldn't hug him.
No. And he told the guard, I didn't hug my mom for 8 months.
Wow. I mean, what was your, what was your feelings when he came out? When he came out of solitary, and he was faced with the task of learning how to interact with other human beings. I mean, it must be a culture shock for your son.
Well, when he first came out, he was only out a couple days, and he got in a fight. The guy punched him in his face, and he fought back. So they put him in, but they didn't put the guy back in.
They put your son back in?
He was out for a couple days,
yeah.
And a guy punched him in the face. And my son fought back, so they put my son back in solitary confinement, but they didn't put the guy in solitary confinement.
Yeah, yeah. How long was the second time?
I think maybe a week or two. They let him back out.
Okay.
And he's
okay.
Been out since.
Okay. And when is he expected to be released from prison?
I have no idea right now. He's waiting for trial.
Oh, okay. And how long has he been in prison so far?
3 years.
Wow.
Now, what kind of changes in him did you see happen during the time that he was in solitary?
When I would go see him, his hands would shake. Yeah, because he was shaky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And to what extent has he recovered since he came out of solitary? Is he the same son you used to have, or is there sort of like a change that's still there?
He's depressed. I can see that he's not the happy child he always was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Steve, I mean, do you have any figures on the mental health problems of people in solitary in New York State, or maybe Chuck does? Maybe.
I can't give you exact figures, but there's an enormous body of research which shows changes psychologically that happen to people in solitary, and increased risk of various kinds of symptoms of mental disorder, like, for instance, self-cutting is something that's practically unknown among adult males. There are women who self-cut and there are adolescents who self-cut, but there are practically no adult males in the population, in our communities, who self-cut. But prisoners, adult male prisoners in solitary, do self-cutting fairly often. The suicide rates are much higher, several times higher. I can't give you the exact number in solitary compared with prisoners in the general population or people in the community. People in solitary start having paranoid feelings sometimes and become unable to cope with being touched. At other times, they become depressed and sink into total despondency and just sort of immovability, just lassitude. There are even brain changes, physical brain changes that appear to happen as a result of solitary. I think we should think of solitary as being like a slow and invisible amputation. It's cutting off a part of a person's mind and soul and spirit.
Yeah.
But doing it invisibly and slowly, because from what I've seen and heard, and I've met a lot of people who've been through solitary who are involved in our campaign in New York State, none of them feel that they've come back 100%.
Yeah.
Not one. And the people that I know and have spoken to are the success cases who've come back enough to be kind of functioning and effective within the movement to change solitary confinement. There's an enormous proportion who never recover enough to be functioning members of the community at all anymore, yeah. who are damaged in really severe ways
yeah.
permanently by their
yeah.
time in solitary.
Yeah. Sam, do you concur with what Steve has said? Or?
Yes. It's similar to there are some guys from like a war Vietnam guy from the desert campaigns. They talk like it's similar to post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
You know, because this whole dehumanizing thing, you know, we are social beings.
Yeah.
And you're being incarcerated while being incarcerated. You know, it's a mental situation. It's a psyche, you know, it's to suppress, you know, that feeling and to break break a person's spirit. And in some cases, it works. It depends on how strong your mind, if you stimulate your mind, if you're doing things to stimulate your mind. Like, let me say, I'm going to get up in the morning, I'm going to do my exercise. I had a certain routine to do. And, you know, I'm going to read my books. And it wasn't just, these are stimulation books, you know, about spirituality and different things to uplift myself and let me know that I'm still human. Though I'm going through a situation now, some people are incarcerated because they need to be incarcerated. Some people are incarcerated because it's a thing of our population control. Now, that's debatable. But the whole thing of solitary confinement, some people need to be contained. And some people go through it because, you know, maybe the CEO is having a bad day. And he really want to show other image that he's not the guy to, you know, maybe lift your voice or voice your opinion to. So they concoct a thing where we're going to show all of them.
Now, to follow on to what Sam was saying.
Sam, wait, hold on. We got a caller.
Yeah, so we have a caller. So
are you on your caller?
Caller?
Thank you. Hey, Charlie, Chuck, Steve, this is Jim. I just wanted to, ask on the other side of getting out of such a confinement, and once you're out back into the public, are there any services available to help you because of that experience? I mean, I think about it in one of the guests just mentioned about, I'm a combat Vietnam veteran myself, and I know the experience of being in war leaves people with stuff, and they're just now getting around and realizing the kind of services they need, you know, in terms of adjusting. So I'm just wondering, after an experience like that in incarceration, are there now any services being offered to that population as we talk about integrating them back into the community?
Yeah.
I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Jim has a radio show on Tuesdays here, I think, on WUFO. Okay, so, Steve, can you answer Jim's question?
I think Sam has a...
Oh, Sam, okay.
I would like to emphasize the program, federal and state programs to deal with inmates are being cut, you know, because, you know, different fundings, you know, they're being cut. So new program to deal with people that in solitary confinement to get out to help them, I guess, maybe a counseling to help them deal with different situations that they go through. There are none. You know, you are just put back in general population.
Yeah.
And the population is where inmate go out and live among other inmates. There is no program you go to. They just up one day and say, yo, pack your things. You're going back out into population.
Right.
So there is no program to integrate you back into, no.
Yeah, I you know, it's almost the same as if you wanted to design a system to keep the population of criminals high, you don't give anybody help when they come out of prison.
No.
I mean, it's only the extraordinary individual who can overcome this lack of help, and such as you and Chuck, and you know, reintegrate into society.
But we are fortunate in Buffalo. We do have some helps available here, not that are the for instance, the Back to Basics Ministry that Pastor James Giles directs.
Correct. Yeah.
Provides a lot of services to people who were formerly incarcerated, including trying to help people adjust to life outside, helping them with finding employment, housing, and also psychological adjustment. And they do it from a perspective of sympathy with what it's like to have been incarcerated, because most of the people who work there were incarcerated themselves. And so, you know, they're able to help a good number of people here, and the Prisoners Are People Too organization also provides a kind of a support network for many people who've been incarcerated here in Buffalo. So there's a little bit that happens here, but
it's not government strongly government supported.
No, not at all.
Yeah,
and it's not adequate to our local needs, and probably most communities around the country have nothing like that.
Yeah.
At all. So it's now one of the things that needs to be emphasized is that that the vast majority, according to Department of Corrections and Community Supervision statistics, 5/6 of the tickets that lead people to go into isolated confinement in New York State prisons are for nonviolent violations of prison rules, and in many cases completely trivial ones,
right?
Things like Sam's,
yes,
you know,
yes, yes.
Bad mouthing and corrections
insolence.
Officer.
They call it insolence. Yeah. Insolence.
And so the people that are in solitary are in most cases are not dangerous. They're not people who have to be separated for safety. Now there are people who are violent behind bars and who are dangerous to other residents of the prison and to staff, but the current system of solitary does nothing to deal with that effectively.
Right.
It just makes it worse. And so what the HALT bill does, the bill that we're that the Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement is pushing, does is it provides an alternate way to deal with the truly problematic prisoners.
And the bishop has supported that, correct?
Yes, yes. Both the Catholic and the Episcopal bishop in Buffalo have endorsed the HALT bill, as well as the Episcopal diocese and I think Riverside Salem Church and a couple of other churches.
Yeah.
What our bill proposes is that the truly problematic prisoners, this small group minority, would be put in units that are separated from the general population, but which are not isolated confinement, where people are still out of cell for many hours a day, having programming that's therapeutic and that's intended to address the issues that make them violent, and where they do congregate things with each other and have meals in congregate settings and worship and so forth, so that people don't become crazy.
Yeah.
They don't are driven mad by solitary confinement, which is what happens.
Yeah.
So and this is really and these kinds of programs have been proven to work. New York State used to have one.
Yeah, for many years.
The Merle Cooper program.
Right. Worked
beautifully and was liked by everyone, by correctional officers, by prisoners. And so it's perfectly possible and had great outcomes, massively lower recidivism and violence.
Until the funding was pulled.
Exactly.
Right. So it's very possible to do something different. And if you focus it only on the 1/6 of prisoners who are truly problematic, and you don't spend all the money putting in solitary the other 5/6 who aren't in any way dangerous, then the resources can be there. We wouldn't have. We'd probably spend less than we spend now.
Yeah,
and be able to really meet people's psychological needs and make them better, which is a boon to all of us. It's a boon to everybody in terms of safety.
To really help
the prisoners who are problematic.
Yeah, this business of isolating human beings. I mean, people who have voluntarily isolated themselves. For example, we have sailors that circle the world alone in their sailboats, and they're away from human interaction, except for the radio, of course. But when the radio goes, they can be out of contact for weeks and months at a time. And there have been some apparent suicides on that issue. I read of a few. And, of course, Terry Anderson, the AP correspondent in Lebanon, wrote a book about his experiences in isolation. And John McCain, who spent 2 years in a North Vietnamese prison, speaks eloquently about his experiences. And there was 150 other naval aviators who were shot down in North Vietnam. And each one of them tell about the horrors of being isolated in prison. And so... the venue, you know, it's not the venue, it's the isolation, it's the social isolation that destroys the brain, eats away at the brain. I can't remember Steve's exact words, but it slowly eats away at the brain and changes the brain waves and profoundly. And in many cases, it's reversible, but in some cases it's not, and we need to help, you know, we need to have government funding to help these people. Private funding cannot even begin to take care of the issue. We have Jane Mack here, and
I'm here.
You're here. Okay, great. Jane, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to comment on the excellent editorials in the Buffalo News the last couple of weeks. This past Saturday and the Saturday before, and other articles, they're getting interested in the prison situation. And the question is, who's guarding the guards? That was the headline of one of their editorials. And that's my question. You asked earlier of Sam, was there any judge or jury or committee or hearing of any kind to review the ticket to the shoe, to the box, to the Bing, whatever it's called? Is there any review of the guards for giving out these tickets and slamming people into these tiny rooms for weeks, months? And I was impressed that Sam...
Jane, I'd like to say that once again, the guards and the officer, the shoe officer, these are people who live in the same community. These are friends. They grew up together. They go out together. They go to each other's weddings, daughters, the anniversaries, daughters, sweet 16s, everything like that. These are people who live together, you know. So,
especially if it's near a small town like the one
you're in. Most of these facilities are in small towns or farming communities. Most of them are built in farming communities to save the community as a whole. So they build these prisons in these farming communities, and these are people that grew up through generations.
The economy of the village or the town, they build the prison, and that's understandable, but the guards are not reviewed, apparently. There is no review of their behavior.
There is no screening. There is no screening them, their psyche, and see if they're able to deal with such things, you know, to deal with such, you know, inmates.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so you're saying there's no screening before they're hired.
No.
And I'm saying there's no review after they're hired.
Some of them will even brag and tell you, as an inmate, they will tell you that I haven't graduated high school.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Now, the situation.
Many of them come back from Afghanistan and Iraq, and they're sensitive to noises. They're suffering from various levels of PTSD, and they they act as if they're still at war. They're still in the battlefield, regardless of where they are in the United States.
Well, let me tell you a couple of things about the New York State situation. First place, there are hearings. When people are sent to the SHU in New York State, but the hearings are what any objective observer would call kangaroo courts.
Yes.
They have a rate of upholding the ticket of like upwards of 95%.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness.
And the prisoner's word is counts for nothing, and you have no right to representation.
No.
Even by another prisoner
so it's
as
an internal
your advocate.
Review.
Right.
So it's the hearing is pretty meaningless.
Right.
Now in terms of the nature of the training and the spirit of prisons, one of the problems is that prisons train their workforces as if they were a military force. I looked through the curriculum that newly hired correction officers go through. They have an 8-week residential training at a special college, and then they do 3 weeks of sort of internship on the job before they're fully qualified corrections officers. And during this training, they get things like over 100 hours of firearms training. This despite the fact that inside a prison, correction officers don't carry weapons. They don't carry guns. The only time they ever use a gun is when they're on perimeter duty or when they're transporting a prisoner to another prisoner or something like that. And they have dozens of hours of training in using chemical agents and things like that. They have like maybe 3 hours of training in suicide prevention, 1 hour in conflict resolution. So the training is all wrong in terms of
absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. We got a few minutes left, and I want to go around for Rosalie and Chuck and Sam for people who are listening who may in the future who are listening to this broadcast and may in the future find themselves in the shoe someday. I mean, what would you recommend they do, or how to prepare your mind for that ordeal that they, a small fraction of us may experience someday. So, Sam, could you lead the charge here?
I would advise anyone who find themselves in such an unfortunate situation to read to stimulate your mind. The mind is a stimulation, so to keep social and active, to read and exercise. Yeah.
Okay. Chuck, how would you?
Yeah. Well. Definitely, but I would reiterate what Sam says. You have to. It's also a choice. You can bend to the oppression. You can give up and be a passive person, or you can stand up and face the consequences too. But I would ask the public to really look into this matter, because when we had President Obama and Pope John speaking out against solitary confinement, there's a real problem.
Right. Right.
And 5,000 prisoners in California going on hunger strike.
Right.
So it's really a time for the public to say, hey, wait a minute, maybe something is amiss. Not all prisoners are douchebags, like that.
Right.
And so it's a good time. I think things are coming to the public is taking some responsibility.
Yeah. Rosalie, can you sort of say what your son might suggest?
My son got himself into a routine, and he started drawing, and he drew my whole house. He knew what the outside of the house looked like, And all these men here are strong, because I have panic attacks and claustrophobia. I wouldn't last in there. I would die in there.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to be a strong person to make it through in there.
Yeah, yeah. And we have... So why don't we all go around? Steve, for last thoughts for everybody here. So why don't we each take turns? Steve?
Well, I would urge you all to speak to your state legislators in the Assembly and in the Senate, and tell them that they really need to endorse and co-sponsor and vote for the Halt Solitary Confinement Act.
Okay. Rosalie?
Well, to pass the law, because these are our sons and our daughters in there.
Okay.
To pass the law for they can not be in there long term anymore.
Okay. And Sam?
Vote.
Okay. Okay.
All right.
Brevity is the mark of genius. Okay. Right. Jane?
Just real quickly, Crystal Peoples-Stokes has co-sponsored the bill in the Senate. The law is already written. All we have to do is ask our representatives to support it. There's one in the Senate and one in the Assembly. Talk to your representatives, please.
Three cheers for Crystal Peoples-Stokes. And Chuck.
Chuck. I hate to inject a pessimistic note, but New York spends about a little over $2 billion a year on their corrections program. That money, that's a phenomenal amount of money. And the resources, if they were targeted to education, which Como points, you know, try to do it a little bit with higher education,
yeah,
it would make such a great difference, you know.
Yeah.
New York hasn't been so bad in terms of population. The prison population has been going down.
Okay.
And that's a plus, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we have to be thankful. But we have to be attentive, too, to what's going on and fight for the good changes that people need.
Jack.
Well, finally, I want to thank Charlie for doing such a wonderful job with all these shows this past summer. And I just wanted to tell everyone that the Peace Center show will be back in some form. We're going to be sort of absorbed by Vantage Point from 2:30 to 4 on Mondays.
Okay.
In September, we're going to go at least 2 to 3 Peace Center shows a month.
That's a big job absorbing me.
We're gonna have issues. It's more going to be on public affairs, but Peace Center issues like with, like Push Buffalo and different organizations that are key to people, you know, partnership for the public good and Mary Darius Pridgen and stuff. We'll try to get people like that on.
And we're not going to hear the weather show anymore?
Oh, the weather show is still going on from noon to 1, but I'm not hosting it starting in the fall. So it'll be the Peace Center show.
All right.
And right now the sports guy is here, so I could have gotten my doorbell ready. We got the doorbell sound effects, but I've already got the all-talk disclaimer.
I just want to thank WBMY for letting the Peace Center host a show this summer, and it's been a learning experience for me, and I want to thank everybody for listening this summer to the terrific shows that we had out, and I want to thank all the guests. I want Chuck, Jane, Sam, Rosalie, and Steve, and thanks for being here. This is Talking Peace.
Thank you, Charlie.
Insights on Peace and Justice with the Western New York Peace Center. This is funded by the Buffalo State Students for Peace activity fee. And this is the final show, and thank you very much for listening.
Thank you all.
91.3 FM WBNY, Buffalo's original alternative, brought to you.